Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Excellent. Doing really good. Excited about our show tonight.
Yeah, me too. Well, it's good to be back live. We did a fully recorded show last week, and I guess that was just you kind of hitting a couple buttons, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. We played the Cory Doctorow interview, and then I came on, introduced the music, and played the music. So that's pretty much the extent of my involvement last week. But the chat room was lively, and the show was interesting to listen to for a second time, and of course, we had to do that because Corey's in the UK, and for time reasons, he could not join us at this hour. So,
yeah, we found a time that worked well for Corey, and pre-recorded the show actually about a week early. So, 2 weeks ago, we were all over this topic. We were talking with Corey, we were talking with Martin Ford. It's like 2 days running. We were having these conversations, and then I didn't even make the show last week. So, we've had some time to kind of let it all sink in, digest. We haven't talked about it, and now we're ready to kind of, come back together and make sense out of all these topics. But before we get into that, since we've got no guest and we can freewheel it just a little bit here, anything else of interest going on these days?
I don't guess so. I watched the Watchmen again. Was it last night or the night before? That movie it blows me away every time I watch it. It makes me mad. It pushes all my buttons. It's just it's an interesting, challenging movie, and I enjoyed it once again. And I guess enjoying is not the right word, but it's an interesting movie.
Well, I like it a lot. I've watched it probably 3 times now. I went to see it when it came out. Then my daughter and I went to see it together, and then I think I've watched it at least once on Amazon download, so that's a lot of times for me. I don't usually watch a movie that many times, so I find it to be a very powerful movie. And there are some infuriating things in there. Although I don't think Ozymandias is the hero.
Yeah,
I don't think we're meant to sympathize with him. And if we are,
but I think the writer,
Alan Moore,
his worldview is very leftist, and I think he was tempting himself with the Ozymandias character and that line of thinking. He was saying, okay, if I could get this, leftist utopia, would it be worth doing what he did? And he was tempting himself with it. And I don't think he answers his own question. My answer, of course, is absolutely not. It's not, the ends do not justify the means.
To me, Rorschach is the hero of the movie.
Yeah, he really is.
And I think we're supposed to think he's like this crazy other extreme.
Exactly.
I think we're supposed to sympathize with Night Owl, right? The the kind of mushy middle characters.
Exactly.
But I don't have much use for them. I like Rorschach, I think.
Well, at least Night Owl was was a little upset when Rorschach.
I like him. I mean, as you're watching the movie, but as far as whose view of what's happened I sort of line up with. I think it would have to be.
By the way, Night Owl and Glenn Reynolds. I've never seen them in the same place at the same time. So
that's a good point. Excellent point. There might be something there.
Exactly. Anyway. But anyway, I understand you've seen an interesting movie in the last couple of days.
Well, a couple weeks ago, actually the same day we talked to Corey, I took my dad to see The Wolfman, which that was fun because my dad first went to see the original Wolfman 70 years ago or so when it came out.
Yeah,
and he was
whenever
like
it came
eight.
Out.
And when I was 9 or 10, it came on TV, and he let me stay up late on a school night, and we watched it together. So it was like this movie from his childhood, this movie from my childhood, and now, you know, here I am kind of middle-aged, and my dad, you know, getting on in years, and they've done a remake of The Wolfman, so we had to go see it together, and we both really enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought that it was a real tribute to the original in a lot of ways. They kept fairly true to the story. Obviously, they're going to take liberties when they do a remake of a movie like that, but the liberties they took, I thought, were a big plus. For example, in the original Wolfman, you've got no werewolf-on-werewolf fights, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's a problem. You need that in a Wolfman movie, I think. A werewolf movie should have one werewolf fighting another. It just seems like... actually, that should probably happen in, like, the second one. But I'm good with it. I like
you're
it.
You're okay with it, yeah.
There's a totally cool fight between two werewolves, and you know, I felt like that had a lot. Also, Benicio del Toro...
Yeah, that guy just can play a werewolf, you know. It's a little bit like when Jack Nicholson played one. He just kind of looks.
He was born for the part.
Yeah.
Well, no, what I was going to say was he looks a lot like Lon Chaney Jr.
Oh, okay, yeah, I guess it kind of does, yeah.
You know, he's built like him. He's got a very similar face. It just seemed like that was great casting. It just felt like they really had a lot of respect for the original movie. So I know it's getting kind of panned by the critics, but I don't care what the critics say. I think if you like werewolf movies,
this is
if
a good
you're a fan
one.
Of the original Wolfman, go see The Wolfman.
And the CGI doesn't just completely destroy the movie. It doesn't. It lends itself to the story. It doesn't take it over. Is what I've heard from a couple people. So
I thought it worked fine. Yeah. Now Roger Ebert in his review said that he found it distracting, and he thought the werewolf looked too light when he was moving around. But I didn't notice that. I did not observe that. I thought he looked very scary when he was running around. So, it
worked for you, then.
Worked for me.
Okay.
So I've got one other bit of interesting news from my life this week. Actually, well, let me just tell you that, I guess, 2 weeks ago, right, when did the Olympics begin? Like 2 weeks ago. So I've got a number of coworkers in Canada. We've got a Toronto office, and we've got an office in Waterloo, Ontario. And actually, one of my closest coworkers is out of the Waterloo office. And we got talking about the upcoming hockey tournament in the Olympics, and we were both pretty psyched about this. And I said, well, I, along with Wayne Gretzky, I'm really hoping that the U.S. and Canada face off in either the finals or the semifinals, because that's going to be like the greatest NHL All-Star game of all time, with with more at stake than you would ever have in a, you know, just a kind of a get together All-Star game. And she agreed that would be completely cool. And after the U.S. beat Canada in that first game, I was like as cool as I could possibly be about it, you know, and still gloat. I mean. Right. Obviously, I had to say something, but you know, I thought I was pretty kind and generous and so forth, and then things swung back around, and sure enough, the U.S. and Canada face each other in the final, and I don't know if you caught any of that.
I did.
Yeah.
What a game! Yeah.
I think the best hockey game I've ever seen in my life. Probably the best hockey game anyone's ever seen. It was just
I mean, going all the way back to when the Americans beat the Russians or the Soviet Union way back when.
It's up there. It's up there. You're right. Yeah it's with that. That's probably the greatest, come to think of it, for an American anyway, right? So so I get to. No emails or anything like that, but I get to work this morning, and the guy drops a FedEx on my desk, and it's from the Ottawa office, Ontario, excuse me, the Waterloo office, and not unusual because I get a lot of stuff from there. But I open it up. There's no papers or anything. There's a pair of mittens. And they're these big, bright red mittens. On one side is the Vancouver 2010 Olympics logo.
Yeah.
And on the other side, the palm side, great big white maple leaf. Okay. So these are like the ultimate Canadian mittens. And sure enough, that was my coworker had sent that to me. She said she knew I was so excited about Canada's victory that I would want to join in the celebration, and she has made me a temporary honorary Canadian. So I think
that's
for the
awesome.
Next few days, I'm Canadian A. So.
Well, that's as close as you can get to a Canadian accent just then, I guess.
Well, I could. I just don't want to talk about it anymore, okay? That's all. That's all I got.
That's awesome. Well, it was a great, great game, and congratulations to any Canadians in the audience. It was hard fought.
Congratulations to Canada. Hard fought, well won, well deserved. You know, in Canada, the number one TV show is Hockey Tonight. They have like, you know, it's like Monday Night Football in the U.S.
Yeah,
that is the top-rated show in Canada. So, I mean, this is a crazy Canada.
Yeah, it would be a little bit like, you know, somebody... You know, if American football became a Olympic sport in some other country, you know, challenging us, I mean, it just, you know, it's the national sport. It has, you know, it has to be won by the nation that loves it as much as Canada. So,
and it was their Olympics, and they set a record for most gold medals won. They won the most gold medals. We won the most medals. So
right.
It's not like the U.S. got, you know, completely.
And I think we won the most medals ever for the Winter Olympics for the United States. It was a good Olympics for us. It was a good Olympics for them. And so congratulations to Vancouver and Canada in general. So, yeah.
There you go.
All right.
Well, I guess now we ought to talk about some the new economy. We've got a whole show lined up here, and we should jump into it. So I thought what we would do is let's just kind of look back over what we talked about the previous 2 weeks. Last week with Cory Doctorow, talking about his book, Makers, and a view of the future economy that he unfolds, kind of in the present tense, sort of set in a futuristic present. And the week prior to that, Martin Ford talking about the ideas outlined in his book, The Lights in the Tunnel. So let's start with Martin Ford. Now, he gives a very succinct thesis around what's going to happen due to the continuous acceleration of automation. What
Right.
happens is accelerating automation eventually leads to widespread unemployment, and in the end you get a complete economic collapse because there's no consumer activity.
Right.
We're all put out of work by the robots. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you know, the economy needs both a supply side and a demand side. And, you know, I don't think that there's any argument about that point. And I don't think there's much argument about the point that automation is continuing to basically produce more and more and more efficiently than humans can. So, you know, you end up not just, you know, factory jobs, I think, for humans are on the way out. You know, I see these incredible videos like on Boing Boing and things like this of these factories that there's not a human in sight.
Right.
And these robots just going 90 to nothing, moving faster and more efficiently than humans could ever think about doing. And, you know, they don't join unions and they don't need pensions. And, you know, it's just... I think that's definitely the way factory work is going, but it's not just that. I mean, you got AI that's going to be taking over more mental jobs more and more. And at some point you go, well, what is it that humans are going to be able to do that robots and machines can't do better? And that's really the question that Martin Ford is asking in his book.
His answer is there's not much, right?
Yeah, his answer is pretty bleak. It's,
yeah, you come up with a world, you end up with a world with about 20% maybe, best case, of the workforce still holding down some kind of employment.
Right.
And 80% of us thrown completely out of work. Now, if that were to happen tomorrow or 10 years from now even, I think if without massive radical changes in how our infrastructure is set up, that would be economic collapse. I mean, there's no question about it. That would, you know, that would be the inverse of the Great Depression, right? The Great Depression was 20% unemployment, right?
Right.
Not 20% employment. 80% unemployment is unheard of. If that were to occur, all things being equal, right? So
right.
We're just taking his argument as it's presented for now. Yes, that's the end. That is the end of our economy.
Right.
And I don't know how you reboot from there. That would be a catastrophe, an unprecedented economic catastrophe. I think is about the only way that you can state it. And what happens is all the wealth ends up in the hands of just a few people. This 20%, or probably, you know, the managers, the management class within that 20%, whoever they'd be, and the rest of us are left with, well, nothing, right? Because we don't have jobs, and we don't have any means of acquiring wealth, so therefore we're not consuming, so therefore the economy is just completely ground to a halt. Now, his solution to that is whatever that remaining productive base is, 20%. I think he said that in the book. He definitely said that to us when he was talking to us.
Right.
You just got to tax the daylights out of them, and whoever they are, and then you're going to provide government stipends to the rest of us, the unlucky, or now it starts to sound kind of lucky, unemployed, who will just collect checks for the rest of our lives. So we'll start spending money so that we'll power the consumer side, the demand side of the economy, and you keep the economy going.
Yeah.
So that's his idea. Now, before we say what we disagree with that, are there any, you know, any good sides to that argument? Anything positive you can say about Martin's model?
It sounds like a comfortable hill. I mean, you talk about meaningless existence. I can't imagine anything worse.
Steve,
no,
that's
I don't.
A con. That is not a pro.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I did my best. I said comfortable hill.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay. Any good things you can say about his model?
Well, I think that it's hard to argue with the fact that that the world is automating and that human jobs are going to be. You know, it's not just that our jobs are going to go overseas,
mm-hmm.
as they are. They go. You know, manufacturing jobs and things tend to go to countries where. Labor is cheap. Well, what if labor is like free, basically, as long if you can pay for a machine?
Right.
You know, it's not exactly free. You have to pay for the machine, but a machine's a whole lot cheaper than a human being, even a human being in some, you know, very, very poor country. And so you build that machine, and then you're done with that, and you just produce all the widgets you like with no humans being involved at all. You do that enough throughout the economy, and all of a sudden, you know, you start seeing a world very similar to his. But here's the thing. There's a lot of things about this. One, you know, if you're able to efficiently produce widgets cheaper and cheaper, then and you pass that along to your customers. Okay, I mean, mm-hmm. if somebody can produce a car extremely cheaply, then you know, it's then they sell that car cheaper, okay? Particularly if there's competition to make the most the cheapest car in the world. It's, you know, my factory is 90% automated, and I'm able to sell a very cheap car. And then somebody comes along whose factory is 95% automated, and they're selling it even cheaper. And so we're competing with one another to see who can outstrip the other. And so what does that mean? That means that people in the world, the demand side of the economy, are able to buy a car with less money than ever before. So
right.
maybe there are fewer jobs to go around, but the need for money has actually reduced because the efficiency of the demand, the supply side of the economy. So there's that aspect of it. In other words, it's rebalanced in that way. But there's another. There's the other part of it, which we're going to get into here in a little while, and that's what Cory Doctorow was talking about, the maker side, where we're able to produce some of our own things at home.
Okay.
So,
okay. We'll come to that.
Yeah. So, but your question was anything positive about it? I guess
anything positive.
The positive thing about it is that he is accurately seeing part of the future there.
I think he nails part of it. I think if all of his assumptions are completely correct and in a completely binary world, everything he assumes is right, then yes, what he suggests would prevent economic collapse.
Yeah.
It also addresses this issue of inequality, just massive inequality of wealth, which we can spend a lot of time talking about that. That, to me, that's an interesting one. I've written about this on the blog more than once. Inequality of wealth doesn't bother me. I don't think that's an issue. I don't think that we should be trying to level off everybody having the same amount of money. The real question is, are poor people getting more? That's actually all that matters. Looking at the difference between the richest and the poorest doesn't matter. What I want to look at is what's the difference between the poorest today and the poorest 2 years ago, right?
Right. Right.
To me, that's always the measure that makes the biggest difference. So addressing inequality, I don't care about. If things got so isolated that nobody had anything, then it's like, okay, maybe something would have to be done to level it out. But it's like I kind of had to strain to come up with major pros for this. But one thing I really did like about it was that he jumps to a quote-unquote socialist solution, but he never puts production into the hands of government. He never says, okay, now the government has to plan the economy.
You know,
it's like it's just trying to put money back into the pockets of the consumer. So it's not socialism in the classic sense. We were talking before the show started. Martin really is a capitalist at heart. He's a guy who's done well for himself in business. So I think he understands that distinction. And even when he's trying to work out a solution that involves the government, I think he makes the very wise move of saying, okay, well, I'm not going to say the government now owns everything or is in charge of the economy.
Yeah.
But even so, having them have that power is just too much. Oh, the last one is that he correctly identifies consumer activity as a good thing, which it absolutely is. It's an absolute driver for everything that occurs in our economy. Okay, so now having said that, there are some good things, definitely some good things about the model. Now, what are the cons? What's wrong with the lights in the tunnel model?
Well, I think
it'd be a very comfortable hell.
Yeah, I think it was the hell aspect of it. It's a meaningless existence if you're sitting around just waiting for your check to come in, where you're basically there's no real point in bettering yourself. There's no real point in having children, in a world like that. I mean, there's no hope for a brighter tomorrow that you can affect in any way. You just kind of exist, and I would think it's basically retirement for the human race is what it amounts to, and I can't imagine anything worse than that sort of thing. I'll put it this way: Kurzweil. He writes about all the positive reasons that humanity might think about becoming post-humanity. I mean, what would be cooler than being super smart, super healthy, super strong, sexy, and happy all the time? I mean, that's
sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, if you will.
Exactly, that person.
Yes.
Don't we all want to be Tony Stark? Wouldn't that be cool? And so he writes about that, and it's very very positive, kind of optimistic books. That's the future that Kurzweil paints. I think what Martin Ford is actually doing, without actually mentioning the possibility of post-humanity at all, is he's actually painting the picture. There's the carrot, and that's what Kurzweil is talking about. Martin Ford's talking about the stick. Here's the reason why we couldn't stay normal human if we wanted to. Here's the reason that we'd be pushed into post-humanity even if we didn't make the choice voluntarily. We need to be as smart as the machines, and we need to be as strong as the machines, and as efficient. And that's And I think that's why we there'll be some that'll choose it, and then some that feel like that they just have to in order to have any kind of meaning in their lives, would push towards it. So,
well, you know, I think that it's maybe I generally agree with you. I think there's a huge problem with a lack of incentives for these consumers in Ford's model. Although I'm not sure it would be quite as bleak as you present. I think about the world. What's her name? Jane Austen, right?
Yeah.
You ever watch any of these movies based on Jane Austen novels? I live with women, so I end up watching quite a few.
I live with a woman, and yes.
So you've seen a few.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's an interesting world, right? This is the late 18th, I guess, early 19th century in England.
Aristocracy, and they're all sitting around with no jobs to speak of.
Gentry, right? I mean, it would be unfashionable. It would be unseemly to have employment, right?
Yeah. That's what the merchant class does.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you sully yourself with that kind of stuff. So what do? Well, they have parties. They go hunting, the guys, right? They get mixed up in ridiculous relationships. That's about it. And that was within a highly mannered, highly structured, not nearly as crass kind of society as we have today. So you look at them and you kind of go, well, that would be the best case. I mean, that's probably about as good as it could get. But the reality is that out of those actual people, there were some who decided to become writers, artists, scientists, and they're a small explorers, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and some who even decided they'd sully their hands and become business people, and who did quite well. So even with the stick off, even with the pressure off, a lot of people just decide to infuse their lives with meaning anyway. They just, you know, that's it's like, well, it's more meaningful for me to do something than not to do something. But I think I tend to agree with you that wouldn't be most people. And
yeah.
And I think most people would end up in a really kind of an empty sort of existence. And one of the things I very much dislike about the model that Ford presents is, well, therefore, we're going to add incentives. And the incentives he adds are, well, for example, being a good environmental citizen. So we're going to pay people more if they're more environmentally correct. I don't care for that one.
Yeah.
We're going to pay people more if they're going to get educated. That one maybe has some legs. We're going to pay people more for living a healthier lifestyle. Any of these kind of social engineering, the government knows best, it's going to incent you to become a better person in the government's view, just kind of makes me shudder. You know, I mean, it just those ideas just don't work for me at all. And I think the potential for coercion between the whatever's left of the productive class and this massively powerful government handing all the money is just, you know, it's too great to be withstood. That would almost have to become a very corrupt central power, and I think it's a non-workable solution in the long run. But I don't think that his assumptions will prove true, at least not precisely the way he presents them. And I think it's a very well thought out, very well presented book. I just think that that his thinking is just a little too binary. It's a little too either or, you know.
Right.
It's this or nothing else, because there are other possibilities. You can have the economy stabilizing around information instead of goods, and you can have a world where people continue to be productive. They continue to add value, even if there's human level AI. That's a possibility. The other possibility, we've talked about it before, is that we get the really good 3D printers. We get the ultimately the nano replicators, and we make our own stuff.
Right. And if we're making our own stuff, then certainly our need for money is reduced. And so, you know, we're not sitting around. And so, the economy is nothing like it would be in that kind of world. It would be nothing like our economy today at all. I mean, if I can make practically everything I need, except for, you know, maybe just a few things that the regional fabricator would have to make for me, then it just comes, my need for money has been reduced to very, very small. I guess you'd need money still to have raw materials and perhaps for food, and beyond that you would not need money. So, and I would think that there would be something that humans in that world could do to earn the little bit of money that they would need to get by. So.
Yeah, although I have to say, now I'm thinking about it. So we've all got our own replicators. We're all just making our own stuff.
Right.
Isn't that a meaningless existence too? Aren't we just aristocrats once again?
Well, for one thing that people would do, and maybe AIs would be doing this even better than people at this point, but the one thing people would do is they'd come up with plans for making a better mousetrap, and they'd put it out on the internet, and other people would say, hey, yeah, I'm going to use my replicator to make this mousetrap instead of this old one here that always seems to catch my fingers. I'll use your mousetrap, and that, that's one way I suppose you'd be creating value, and you could and there'd be some meaning to what you're doing. You wouldn't just be printing out stuff, although that's probably what you'd be doing 90% of the time, but you would also be coming up with ideas. Hmm. And that might be one thing. So
maybe and a world where we're all on stipends, we might all create stuff and just give it out for free. So
yeah,
there's possibilities there. Okay, so now let's swing it around and let's contrast. I think we were talking earlier before the program about how this isn't exactly point counterpoint between Martin Ford and Cory Doctorow. It's more like point and here's another point. So step us through Cory's scenario for the future economy.
Okay, so we know how things have gone for, say, the print industry. Once upon a time there was a print world where just a few corporations controlled the access to being able to print books, print newspapers, print magazines, and they controlled these things, and therefore information was controlled as well, and there was a sort of a uniformity in what the public had access to, the information the public had access to. Well, the internet has changed all that for the printed word. Anybody that has a computer with an internet connection can now, type up something, and to the extent that people care to read what they've written, they could share it with the entire world. And so that's obviously changed things, and and music is the same way. Now, the tools for an audio studio basically can be had by anybody. Anyone that has any musical talent at all now can basically put together something that sounds very polished, and put it out there for the world to hear. And movies are becoming the same way. It's the entry level for producing a independent film is going down and down and down. And so we're seeing now the beginning of a fab lab world where there's the beginning of sort of a hacker culture right now, where there are a few folks out there with 3D printers that are producing not really complicated things, but knickknacks at this point almost. But as time goes by, the complexity of what these 3D printers are able to do is going up, and even basic electronics now can be done, and with sophisticated printers. And I only expect to see that getting more, becoming more prevalent as these 3D printers become more complex. And so That's the direction that we're going, and that's sort of what his book is about. The book is called Makers, and it's about this hacker culture and how the larger commercial world is trying to harness this hacker culture that's making these things in their garage to try to stay relevant and stay alive in the world. It's a fascinating book. It's a great read. I recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, terrific book. So in this future, this world of the makers being kind of this 3D hackers, right? This people who make stuff. You've got some of the same strands from Martin Ford, right? You've got accelerating automation that is leading to people being unemployed, but you don't have total economic collapse.
Yeah.
What you have is this kind of creative destruction of the old economy. That's what Cory Doctorow sort of represents. I mean, it's like the old economy is disappearing, but something new is coming in its place. It's not just leaving a huge void. And per your point earlier, you've got a situation where goods are becoming cheaper and cheaper, and the ability to produce them is distributed. But it's partial and it's imperfect. And so the general population is beginning to pick up this capability, but initially they're doing it in order to produce stuff to be consumed, and it doesn't quite gel, right? It doesn't quite catch up. Meanwhile, you've got other kinds of economic models that begin to emerge, and that's where this whole subplot around a shantytown comes into play. And the shantytown, I think, is important because there's not necessarily major technological leaps that have to occur in order for the luxury shantytown scenario to occur. All you need is an economy that continues to produce more and more stuff and have that stuff available and virtually having no value and people taking that and then going and making, you know, building their community out of it. Now, in the book, it's unclear to me, but I think that probably the fact that shantytown is adjacent to these two makers who were real virtuosos on the 3D printers doesn't hurt, right? They're probably producing a lot of the stuff that
I suspect if Cory got something wrong in that book, it's that in that future I would think that it would be more distributed than that. You would have more than just one virtuoso or two per shantytown. You'd have, I mean, it'd be going on throughout the ghetto, you know.
Oh well, and in fact, there were people with 3D printers in the ghetto.
Right.
They were doing their own stuff, but I was just thinking those guys can really crank out some interesting stuff. Yeah, you know,
yeah.
They're always kind of cutting edge on it. And the point is, even the virtuosos aren't quite at the point of bootstrapping. You know, there's reference in the book to 3D printers that are printing food, right? But you got to put food in to get food out, right?
Right,
you're not at the point yet where you can put dirt in and get food out. You're not at the point yet where you can just go to the dump, throw a bunch of trash into the hopper, and print out a new car, right?
Yeah, I always when people start talking about nanofactories and things, I always want to make the distinction. Now, look, Fab Labs and 3D printing, by that I mean 3D printers, they're going to be with us long before these nanofactories will be with us, and they are going to completely revolutionize the world, you know, long before, you know, Jean-Luc Picard asked for Earl Grey hot, you know. I mean, it's the Fab Labs are going to completely revolutionize the world, and in much the way I think you see in Makers, I really believe that. But
well, and. Just a sidebar, my wife and I have been watching the Star Trek movies. Okay,
yeah.
So we watched Star Trek IV the other night, and I got thinking about this
computer.
Again. Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, exactly that part, okay?
All right.
Now, surely a Klingon ship, for those not familiar with Star Trek IV, just real quick, basically the crew of the Enterprise have stolen a Klingon ship. They've gone back in time. They're in San Francisco of the 1980s. And they have to do certain things in order to get back to their time. And one of them is this completely ridiculous thing about using nuclear fission engines to recharge the dilithium crystals. But another interesting thing that's going on is Scotty is going to get some plastic, some plexiglass, to put in one of the bays in the ship so that they can make an aquarium to hold two whales. So he has to go procure shelving. He has to go procure walls within the starship. Now, this is a starship that has replication technology, and they're in Golden Gate Park, right? Couldn't they just get a shovel and literally dig up a bunch of dirt, take it into the replicator, put it in there, and produce transparent aluminum? Why? Why can't they do that?
You wouldn't have had that wonderful scene, though, with Scotty.
I know, it's a great scene.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, why don't you just replicate an entire starship? Why have these scenes where they, you know, are showing, you know, them building and welding on and putting together the starship?
Exactly where I was going next.
Yeah. Well, because it's fun to watch. I mean, it's interesting to see people working on and building a starship. I mean, it's a lot more interesting than just
seeing
it.
Although not accurate, I think it does capture something, the fact that they've got replicators, and yet they've also still got this manufacturing infrastructure requirement in the Star Trek world, actually captures a potential gap that we do come up against eventually, which is that we're able to produce a lot of stuff, but we're still also not able to produce a lot of stuff. And there'll be an interesting gap between the two, and you have this... jobs are being automated out of existence, but people are finding new things to do. People can produce a lot of things, but they can't produce everything that they need. You know, where does that take us? I don't think it takes us anywhere nearly as pat as where Martin Ford wants to take us. I think he's got a very clean, theoretically sounding model of it all. I think Corey's makes a lot more sense because it's all kind of fuzzy. It doesn't go in directions that you expect. And ultimately, you get to the end of the book. He hasn't presented a solution. We don't know where it's going next, right?
That's right. It's not. Well, that's the thing about it. You know, always in motion is the future. You know, so
yes,
says Yoda. But anyway, that's everything. There is no end to history. Doesn't end. You know, and we never know quite how things are about to go. And you have all these different things that are interacting with one another, and you know, I think that Martin Ford's got a strong handle on part of the picture. I think Cory Doctorow has a handle on part of the picture, and these pictures though are going to interact with each other in ways that'll be surprising to Cory and to Martin and to you and to I and to everybody else.
Mm.
It's going to it's going to be interesting. See how this all plays out, and I hope we don't end up in a situation where we're just sitting around, either having the machines make things for us in our own homes, or receiving checks to have the machines send us stuff, you know, that are being made in factories. That's not the bright future that I'm hoping for.
Well, but you and I will be fine, right? Because if they start giving us stipend checks, we'll just do this show 4 hours a day, right? Or eight, or whatever. You know,
whatever, yeah.
We'll do 11 blog posts a day. I'll be okay, you know.
Well, it'll be a pretty dull show. It'll be like, you know, well, Phil, did you do anything interesting today? And you say, well, no, not really. That was my mailbox.
Star
got
Trek
a check.
4 again.
Yeah, Star Trek 4. And that was awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, I mean, you got
to
have...
Scotty tries to talk to the mouse. That's hilarious.
You know, at some point, I mean, if you got to have things going on in your life that are, you know, give your life meaning, and I just don't see that as a meaningful future. Now, that's and I think Martin Ford would argue with me. Well, that's no reason for believing that it won't happen that way.
Well, I think that's true.
You know, just because you don't want a thing doesn't mean that that's not the way it's going
to
happen.
Just
because
it looks meaningless to you doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that would be a good argument for why people shouldn't own television, right? I mean,
exactly. People would, you know, if we invent television, people are just going to sit on their couch and just watch this thing all the time, and they'll do nothing.
As much. Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
And so, yeah, but that's exactly. So, well, what are you going to do?
But I think I honestly do think whether we're rolling our own with nano replicators, or whether we're receiving government checks, those of us who have already become makers to a certain extent would probably just make more. I really think we would continue to try to find meaningful things to do with our time, and would at least strive to make interesting things happen. It is true though, because it's like it's interesting to picture what fast forward radio is about in that world. Because we're kind of over the rainbow at that point. It's like, well, but really not. I mean, there would still be interesting developments occurring. This is still a post-singularity world we're talking about.
Right.
Or at least to a certain extent post-singularity, or pre-singularity world that we're talking about. So there's still things to live to see at that point. But, well, let's talk about some of these alternative models. And we've been referencing one of them, which is the nanotechnology roll your own economy via replicators model. And then the other one that I list is the post-singularity utopia, which is where the advanced AI solves economics the way AI has already solved the game of checkers is the analogy I use, and we live in the single.
No booms, no busts, just a steady upward climb. It's basically what you're thinking, huh, at that point.
Well, I noticed in the chat room, Sally was saying, you know, there's this tension between do we go with a centralized model or a decentralized model, and she favors a decentralized model. Well, the roll your own economy via replicators is the ultimate decentralized model.
Right.
And then I guess really the robot overlords of the post-singularity utopia is kind of the ultimate centralized model. It's the final benevolent dictator who gets to call all the shots. And interestingly, you can see strands of the roll your own economy in Makers, and you can see strands of this kind of post-singularity utopia in Martin Ford, but I don't think either of those authors would be comfortable with those scenarios.
Right.
I Martin Ford, I think, considers any of that talk about human-level AI and the singularity to be a little too speculative and not something he wants to get into. And
right.
Cory Doctorow is just interested in what he's interested in writing about. And when you push him into a completely different direction, he's like, well, that's not what
he just wants. He just wants to write a good story. And,
yeah, exactly.
And he does a very good job doing that. So. But, the reason, particularly with science fiction, that a story is good is because it's plausible. You can look at this and go, yeah, I can see this actually happening. And so I think that's one of the reasons we like the makers so much. So.
So of those two scenarios, Stephen, which do you put, or do you have a third or a fourth? That you consider more likely, or do you see one or the other of those as being the most likely scenario for the future?
Well, I see with large scale production going very much the way Martin Ford is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to building cars and things like that, I think you're going to see these factories going total automation. It's just cheaper. There's just humans are a hassle. When it comes, as far a human workforce is just a hassle, and it's expensive by comparison to totally automating everything. So I see it going that direction. When it comes to making smaller things, I see us doing that at home more and more. And then there's the third thing that this world would tend to push us towards would be post-humanity. If we got a world that's where the jobs and the meaningful work in the world is being done by machines, then we will want to be a part of that, and it'll push us in that direction. So I think, but again, I see us all being surprised. I think that there's all aspects of this where there's too many variables floating in too many directions for us to have any real handle on where this is going and how fast it'll get here.
Hmm.
So,
well, I noticed that Ken writes that since robots and humans will converge, there will be no robot overlords. Now, I agree with the sentiment there, but I think that
there'll be a robot overlord, but it might be Phil. So,
well, yeah, it's very likely will be me. But actually, if I understand the singleton argument, it is that the first mover AI that takes over, even as we're playing catch up, it's still moving ahead of us a million times, at that greatly accelerated pace. So that even if we're moving along very nicely and becoming much much more sophisticated than we were and enjoying a much grander level of existence than we knew before, the singleton's going to be a lot farther ahead of us and actually still could play that robot overlord role. That convergence of humans with robots doesn't necessarily mean equality across the board any more than applying a certain economic solution would level out the amount of wealth. There still might be greater intelligences and lesser intelligences within a post-singularity continuum, and greater powers and lesser powers. There might be beings who, for our good have pretty much taken over. And that's a very uncomfortable model for a lot of us in a lot of ways. And I have to say that I sure want that to be a very nice singleton that respects my volition and respects my, basically that leaves me alone, right?
Yeah.
It can set the world up nice for me, but, don't go, tweaking with my life, right? and that's a real fine line. I think that we'll probably have to have something like that, though, even in Sally's perfect libertarian nanotech society that she's describing here in the chat room. There's this real danger around a world full of people with machines that can make anything.
Yeah.
There's the potential for people to make anything, right? And if
right.
you can, you know,
Moore's law for mad scientists.
Exactly, right? You know,
the IQ necessary to destroy the world, drops by a point every year. So
there it goes. So if you got a machine that can make anthrax or nuclear weapons or whatever, I mean, eventually some bozo is going to get the bright idea to start making that. Now there's all kinds of countermeasures and there's all kinds of I can make a machine that. That prevents them from, but ultimately you think, it does seem that there would need to be some kind of authority over, some kind of regulating authority over all of the replication activity, or, we could potentially be in a lot of trouble there. Now, I by that I don't necessarily mean a police force or an army or, I do kind of favor the idea of kind of a giant robot army because I think it would be cool, especially if they had like rockets coming out of the bottom of their feet.
Mechas are cool. So
yeah, like mechas. But it might very well be a group of artificial intelligences that act as a governing committee. The way there's a governing committee that manages the World Wide Web protocol, right? There's just this like this replication protocol. That keeps bombs from being made, or that that snuffs those out when they do, or just whatever it would be. But it's possible that we would see a real blending of the two scenarios, where we're all just pretty much able to run our own lives and make our own stuff and create our own reality. But ultimately, there's this AI or this AI infrastructure that's kind of keeping the ball from going out of bounds, I guess. With the ball going out, by ball going out of bounds, I mean world from ending.
Yes.
So I think those are both possibilities. Actually, Sally says that giant robots would be kind of klutzy. Nanobots would be far more supple. I think that
may be true, but
it would probably manifest itself as utility fog.
I think at some point we, a giant mecha is going to be made, and just so some country could say, yeah, and we have a giant mecha. So, it's sort of like cruise missile diplomacy. Have you ever heard that term, Phil? It's like launch a cruise missile and it circles over your enemy's capital, and then you get on the phone with them and say, you think we can work it out now?
Can we sit down and talk about things? Yeah, I just want to talk.
Right. Well, mecha diplomacy would be very, very similar. You just have that mecha walk up to their border, and give them a call, and ask if we can work this out now. So maybe that's.
Well, I think we can have mecha detente because everybody can have a mecha, right?
That's right.
Everybody can have a giant robot.
It's really more a sport than warfare because nobody really gets hurt. They just have these giant mechas out there fighting.
You want to talk about a hockey game?
That's right. Oh, that would be awesome.
About a half mile square rink they'd be playing on there, huh?
Jet
skates they'd be wearing. 2-ton puck they'd be smacking around. Now that right there would be a hockey game. Yeah, I think that I believe that the bottom line on figuring a lot of this out comes back to this notion of solving economics. I don't think we understand economics as well as we think we do. We were talking briefly before the show started about this. I've been reading The Wealth of Nations, and one of the interesting ideas I came upon there was the labor theory of value. This is what Marx got a hold of. He ran with it. It became a prominent notion of what value is until the utilitarian view of notion of value came into play. So they're almost polar opposites of each other. Labor theory is a thing is worth all the toil and pain that you have to go through to get it, labor theory of value,
right.
Or a thing is worth all the joy it brings once you have it, right? All the satisfaction that you get out of owning it. Now,
I'm a subscriber to the second theory, the utilitarian view of value.
The utilitarian view of value is obviously at the heart of what I call the human imperative, right?
Right.
We're going for greater satisfaction, greater utility all the while. Martin Ford seems to give us a world based on kind of a labor theory of value. Cory Doctorow gives us kind of a utility view of value. The thing about it is we talk glibly and knowledgeably about whole economies.
Yeah.
But the truth is we don't even know what value is. Okay. You know, I mean, we've got competing models, and there actually are times when actually the labor theory seems to make a little bit more sense, and times when the utility theory seems to make a little more sense. We've been theorizing about economics, I guess, forever. They got really formalized starting in the late 18th century into the 19th and 20th centuries, and we've been trying to practice, you know, actually roll theories into practice over that period of time. But I'm thinking that we're kind of at a steampunk level with economics right now.
Well, you know, let me explain why I'm a subscriber to utilitarian theory of value as opposed to the labor theory of value. Why is it that some things like, you know, perhaps a giant mecca or a moon base don't get made? It's because the amount of, you know, utility that we would get out of a giant mecca or a moon base is less than we're willing to pay for it. Okay, if it's not, you know, it's not that I could, you know, just, well, I'm going to charge, you know, I'm going to make this giant mecca, and therefore all the R&D that I put into it, and all the blood, sweat, and tears that I put into making this thing, and all of a sudden people are going to be standing in line to buy this mecca from me because of what I've done to deliver it. I will do those things to deliver it if somebody comes to me and says, Stephen, I'll give you $1 billion, and here's all this money that you need to build a mecca if you'll make one for us. And so I guess that's why I'm a subscriber to the utilitarian theory of value. It's the usefulness that somebody would think that they would get out of something that makes it worthwhile to make it. So
well, I agree. One of the economists wrote, and it wasn't Smith, but where did I read this? But the argument was that the pearls aren't valuable because people dive for them; they dive for them because they're valuable. Right?
That's right.
You know,
somebody wants a pearl for their wife, and they think that their wife will be happy with them if they give them one. That's and therefore they're willing, and because they're rare and there's not that many to go around, there's competition for the few pearls in the world, and that's what creates the value. And so,
yeah.
Not the fact that it's very hard to get to them, but the fact that they are very hard to get to makes them rare. And therefore,
I think we're in agreement.
We're going in circles, aren't we?
But my point is that
yeah.
We're probably at a point now talking about economics the way people were talking about genetics back before they discovered DNA. That's my home. I think, you know, we've got a few good ideas, but maybe we don't see the whole picture yet.
Maybe we need an AI to help solve the economy. Is basically what you're getting to, isn't it?
That's my thought, and that's my final thought as we head into the music. I see we're close to our time.
Very close. The music tonight is from Scott Andrew, and it's a hopeful thought, hopeful song. More good days than bad days.
More good days than bad days. Perfect. Closing for our show. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Great talking with you as always. Thanks to our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and to everyone listening to this program. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week, and until then, live to see it. I'm spending too long.
over me. They tell me you could do with a bit more time, but I think that you'd rather be free. See, I heard you bend down, no one comes around, and not too many hours to spare. So come on, let me take you away from here. We'll burn for the horizon, let it be a last souvenir. So turn the bed down, take the needle out, and let me help you into your shoes. Only you can say how your story ends. You're the only one who can choose. And now we're long gone on the 101, and we got nothing better to do. Think about the last time you felt this high, with the sun in the sky and the vibe I'm sending to you. More good days than bad days, it's good to be on your own. More good days than bad days, but you don't have to go it alone. Now on the flat top after Mission Rock, you've got no destination in mind. Put your arm around me as I pull you close. Just pick a new direction and drive, and pay the last toll as the credits roll, as another day comes to an end. Let it wrap you in a blanket of desert sky, with the light in your eyes, let me see you shine once again. Most good days and bad days, yeah, it's good to be on your own. Most good days and bad days, but you don't have. California.